Hello and welcome to the In For A Penny podcast. I'm Mark Schoffman, a freelance personal finance journalist, and I'm joined by my financial planner friend Joshua Gerstler, who runs an advisory business called The Orchard Practice.
Hello.
If you'd like to know a little bit more about us, you can check me out at www.cavendishcontent.com and Josh at www.topfs.co.uk.
Each episode, we aim to give our perspective on the world of finance and money, and discuss some of the issues that crop up in business as well as everyday life. We hope that you'll learn something from our podcast as well as have some fun too.
Hi, thank you for downloading the latest episode of the In For A Penny podcast. Do you want to say hello, Josh? How are you?
Hello, Josh. How are you?
How is life?
Life's good, mate. Life's really good. Yeah, it's living the dream.
So lockdown is not yet eased. This was a week where the government's exit strategy was revealed to not be so much of an exit, more of a slow crawl out of the slight crevice of light shining through a very dark cave. Locks it. Yeah. Which is sort of hard for some people, I guess. Living with, I don't know, you're locked in with your partners, kids.
I think some people are doing well. Some people are struggling.
So I thought we're going to look into that a bit on this episode. And talk about divorce, which isn't necessarily the most upbeat subject, but I think it's good to be prepared.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I've done a bit of research because obviously married couples will have been spending a lot of time together during lockdown. And as you said, it'll bring some closer. And for some, it will bring to the fore the frustrations, like being annoyed with partners who put their feet on the table.
Is that you or your wife?
She wouldn't dare put her feet on the table.
And who chews loudly, you or her?
Neither of us. My wife is absolutely perfect. This episode is not aimed at her.
A Zoom thing on Sunday night with some friends playing games. And at one point, one of the other people said, "Why have you muted yourself?"
Yeah,
I said, we were arguing at that point. I said, "We're just having an argument. We'll be off mute in a minute."
But you're obviously doing well. You're not, you know, your marriage is surviving.
Yeah, we're good. We're good.
Good.
She told me to say that. No, I'm happy.
There was a spike in divorce applications in China after it lifted its lockdown restrictions earlier this year. So I don't know, some couples may need to watch out. And there has been some anecdotal evidence of increased divorce inquiries in the UK so far. So I'm going to try and dig into that. So we are joined by Charlotte Coyle, a senior associate in the family team at law firm Goodman Derrick, to talk through the financial practicalities of getting divorced.
Hello.
Hi
Mark. Hi Josh.
Hello Charlotte.
Hello. Thank you for joining us. So let's start with you guys. So have you seen an increase in inquiries about divorces during lockdown?
I mean, this is definitely a hot topic at the moment. Like you said, it's been commented in the media. That prediction among divorce lawyers is that post-lockdown, it's very likely that the divorce rates will rise. I mean, personally, I've seen and received several new inquiries since lockdown, but I wouldn't necessarily attribute that to a result of obviously the lockdown itself. I would say it's more a majority of these in relation to kind of arranging child contact and working out the logistics. But without seeing any statistical evidence, obviously you said about China, there's a huge spike. We haven't yet seen that, but I think there could potentially be a peak after lockdown's lifted. I mean, if relationships are already quite tense and fraught, then a long time of confinement together will definitely force any underlying cracks to the surface. I mean, living with anyone for this length of time tests the most strongest of relationships. So there'll, in my opinion, be a high possibility that we could see an increase for sure.
It's a bit of a shame, really, isn't it? That it's supposed to be a time where you can spend more quality time with your family, but that it does lead to problems rather than happiness.
Definitely, I would agree. I think any kind of long periods, I mean, we do see a slight increase post-Christmas and post-summer. I mean, whether or not that's a coincidence, I don't know. But I mean, any long period with someone that you're finding difficult to get on with in the first place can just obviously exacerbate the situation. But yeah, it's a shame.
So I guess people associate the point that you get to divorce with acrimony and a lot of arguments and kind of breaking point for most people. Is there such a thing as an amicable divorce?
I've seen it a couple of times. It's great when you hear couples ever reached an agreement between themselves and they haven't had the need of including solicitors in negotiating or dealing with any kind of issues of dispute. But I mean, an amicable divorce, whether or not that exists is another thing. I think I would be extremely cautious. Maybe it's just the lawyer inside me, that even if an agreement had been made amicably between you and your ex-partner, I would even suggest that they go and see a solicitor anyway, just to look over the terms of the agreement, because you want to make sure that you've not missed anything. And then whether or not it be a practical point in terms of form filling, or kind of looking over an overall settlement that they've agreed between themselves, you want another kind of set of eyes to look over that and see if it's fair and reasonable. Because even though you've reached an agreement between yourselves, there's nothing stopping you seeking kind of independent advice just to have another look through and make sure it's all in the best interests of that person, because you don't know whether or not you've agreed to something that's not necessarily fair in the whole scheme of things. But I do, I have seen it a couple of times, but they've always come to me just to finalise everything into an order, make sure it's all kind of the I's are dotted and T's are crossed.
I guess the risk is, as soon as you start mentioning lawyers, people get cagey, don't they?
Definitely. I think if you've reached an agreement between you and your ex-partner, that's great, but you're obviously going to be looking after number one and making sure that you're looked after, and if there's children involved as well, you want to make sure their interests are served in the most appropriate way. So I think there's no harm in mentioning the L word, the lawyer, and just approaching them just to even look over the agreement that you've reached, just to make sure, to double check.
So how do fees typically work, Charlotte? What do people need to think about when they speak to their solicitor in terms of costs?
So from an amicable point of view, if you've come to an agreement and you just want someone to simply look over, you can ask the solicitor whether or not they've got an hourly fee charge that they would obviously charge out with looking over the document and finalising that kind of work for them. Or if they obviously want to instruct the solicitor from the get-go and ask them to advise and negotiate a settlement, deal with any issues regarding contact, etc., then they'd ask for kind of an estimate of costs. And based on, I mean, every case is completely different, so it would just depend on that particular case, but solicitors would most likely give them a fee estimate of how much roughly it would be, so they could budget that within the proceedings.
So do people ever come to you with a disagreement and then they see the costs and suddenly realise it may be better to be amicable?
Yes, completely. I think a lot of people, I mean, it depends on what client, but if they have a point that they really want to run and you're obviously asking and telling them and advising that it's unrealistic expectations that they've set, or advising them on the law, they might necessarily still want to run with it, knowing the cost implications, or they might just say, okay, I'll kind of deal with that in another way, or try and leave that point.
If things are going amicably, how can assets be split fairly?
So in terms of splitting assets, I mean, everything has been dealt with case by case, and there's no standard formula for kind of calculating the appropriate financial provision on divorce. If you've reached an agreement amicably, you should be looking at factors that are included within the marriage. So the court uses Section 25 of the Matrimonial Causes Act 1973 as kind of the range of factors that need to be taken into consideration when calculating and distributing the party's available resources. So they'll first consider obviously the welfare of any child under the age of 18, and then they'll look to Section 25 factors, for example, the capital and income resources of both of them, financial needs, standards of living, ages, length of marriage, stuff like contributions will also be additional factors in conduct. So they'll take into consideration all of those factors, and the starting point, I mean, will always be that the assets will be divided equally, and they'll use guiding principles such as kind of equal sharing and needs compensation as principles to apply in reaching kind of a fair outcome between them both. So for example, the matrimonial home, that's normally considered the matrimonial asset in a lot of cases that we see. That's the main source of kind of that's the main asset that they have. So divided equally between the parties, even if it was owned by one of them before the marriage, could be seen as an equal and fair division of assets.
Does that mean you always have to sell a property if you're going to get divorced?
No, not necessarily. I mean, that when the scenarios where the equal division of assets may not meet kind of both the needs of both the parties, for example, when, for example, a wife might be living in a property with the children, but there's not enough assets for example, the husband to rehouse, they would, in that case, apply the sharing principle with a reallocation of assets in the future. For example, they might have a charge on the property and they might agree for that property to be sold once the children have reached 18. And then that's when the assets are kind of distributed. So one party might have a deferred interest in the matrimonial home at that point. So you can be creative. There's lots of, I mean, every case is completely different and what the needs are of that family and how they're going to divide the assets up. But that's usually one example of when the children are quite young, there's not enough assets to meet the needs of both parties, is that they can, one party stays in the property with the children and then it's sold.
Charlotte, we sometimes have clients come to us looking for mortgages to buy properties. So let's use an example. Let's say the wife and the children got to stay in the matrimonial home, but for whatever reason the husband or the ex-husband has had to stay on the mortgage because the wife can't afford it in her name. That sometimes stops the husband being able to get a mortgage in his own right for a new property. So can that ever be discussed and factored in before the divorce to make sure there's not a problem for the husband?
Yeah, that's definitely something we would advise at the very beginning, is to find out obviously mortgage capacities of both parties and to serve notice on the mortgage company to see what their kind of their stance is on that kind of scenario. Like you said, a lot of mortgage companies will not allow one party to kind of be released from the mortgage, despite it being that one party remains there with the children. But that is definitely a scenario that we face, and a lot of our clients have difficulty in then rehousing, or obviously, like you said, finding another mortgage that they can have.
What other assets are considered?
As part of the disclosure exercise, both parties will have to complete something called a Form E, whether or not that's done by voluntary or by a court-managed direction. You share disclosure with each other, so you include your assets, liabilities, income and expenditure, and within that you gather what is considered in the matrimonial pot, which is assets that both parties have accrued prior and including within the marriage, and that's all kind of put into a schedule and everything's kind of looked at. I mean, it depends completely on needs, but where significant matrimonial finances assets are generated by a special contribution by one party, they can be looked at as well. So if needs aren't met, they can look to other assets, if that makes sense. So possibly something that they've got in their sole name that's not in shared names, for example.
I've always liked the Form E. I know it's two words, form and the letter E, but in my mind it's F-O-R-M-Y. Could you just fill in this little form E for me? It just sounds more enjoyable for me.
Yeah. It's a very, very big document. Yeah.
How do you make sure that your other half is being honest and submitting all the information in the form? Because if it's a divorce that's gone a bit bitter, how can you make sure that's the case?
Yeah, completely. I mean, a lot of my clients face this at the disclosure point, is that one party fails to be frank and open about their assets and where their assets are. The most important thing to do is to try and raise questions, whether or not that's court managed. So when I say court managed, I mean if there are Form A being issued and there's directions for a questionnaire to be raised. If they haven't had that direction by way of the Form A, they can ask the other side whether or not they'd be willing to answer a questionnaire, and within that questionnaire you would ask specific questions about kind of the gaps in the Form E. Or if one client knows about something that they haven't put in their Form E, then you can raise something called a questionnaire And if they still haven't completed or provided any of the information, then they would, there's something called a schedule of deficiencies. But I mean, it just racks up costs. So it's not in the best interest of either party to be going around that kind of exercise and trying to get them to disclose. I think the most
is non-disclosure illegal?
It is, it's not necessarily illegal, but it is definitely frowned upon.
So if the divorce goes through and then afterwards you find out that your ex forgot to tell you they've got another £1 million sitting in the bank, do you have any recourse?
Yes, this actually happened in a previous case I was dealing with, was that we reached a final agreement, everything was settled, and then the one of the parties found out that the ex-spouse had actually been hiding a considerable amount of assets in his name. So we then made an application to vary the order. So if you do have evidence or find out post final order, you can make an application to vary and ask the court to consider and reconsider the
Is there a limit on that? Because what if your ex-partner wins the lottery, I don't know, 2 weeks after you get divorced?
Gutted.
No, that wouldn't be taken into account post, because the final settlement is up until that stage. Once the final order's been made, that's it. You can't then go back for a second bite of the cherry, almost, once. But if there has been failure to disclose any kind of information during the proceedings, then you can apply to vary. Or, for example, if your needs changed, and that's in terms of maintenance and those aspects, then you can go back and apply.
So can you tell us a bit about, often in a relationship, there's not equality in terms of earnings. So husband and wife might be earning different amounts. One might be a bigger earner than the other. How does that get factored into the divorce?
So that can be looked at by way of maintenance. So sometimes the court awards maintenance for a fixed period of time, for example, to enable a pay to become self-sufficient. So if one party earns less than the other party, or indeed have been staying at home looking after the children, for example, and doesn't have the earning capacity that the other party might have, the pay might apply to extend the term, for example, if they're unable to obtain employment and to support themselves. So that's a way that the court might award a level of maintenance to them so that they can their needs can be met and their standard of living during the marriage could be kind of upheld during that period.
Will it always be taken into account to make sure that the person paying the maintenance still has enough money for themselves? So by that, I mean, would they ever get asked to pay more than they're bringing in?
So when the matter of maintenance is discussed, you obviously, through the Form E or through the disclosure, you'll find out their income, outgoings, what expenditure they are paying. And that's kind of dealt with as part of the calculation. So they would never be able to kind of be awarded something that is kind of impossible, they're not going to be able to pay.
Okay, and then post settlement, what happens if the person paying the maintenance either loses their job, salary goes down, or salary goes up? Does the maintenance get changed in that situation?
Yes, so that was a query that I had recently, actually, and that's that obviously due to the coronavirus pandemic, people aren't being paid the same kind of salary, so their income's not the same. So whether or not they can apply to vary maintenance, and that's definitely something that they would be able to do. They'd obviously have to show evidence to say that they've made every effort possible to reduce any other outgoings, and you'd have to present to the court obviously what's changed, evidence of that, and based on that, it's because it's all individual, everything's dealt with case by case, and the judge would look at evidence before it to say your income's obviously reduced significantly, and in line with what you're paying maintenance wise that can be reduced as well.
And is there a period that the maintenance lasts for typically?
So maintenance is an umbrella term, so that includes both spousal and child maintenance. So spousal maintenance, for example, will be achieved if there's insufficient assets to achieve a clean break. And that may be that one party has to pay ongoing maintenance to the other. And that generally ceases when one of the following occurs. And that could be when that party remarries, or that party dies, or if there's a further order of the court. In terms of child maintenance, that is a completely separate issue, and that's dealt with through the Child Maintenance Service. They have kind of the primary jurisdiction of that, and they assess child maintenance that should be paid by the non-resident party. And that will obviously seize upon the child reaching 18. I mean, both parties can agree to pay an additional source of funds on top of that, but it's usually when the child reaches 18 that those child maintenance payments start.
We sometimes have clients come to us looking to protect the maintenance. So if the wife is the one paying the maintenance, the husband might decide to take out a life insurance policy on the wife's life so that if she dies, that the family can still continue to receive the income that she was paying to them.
Yes, I think that's definitely advisable to do so. Yeah.
What about your pension? Where does that come into all of this?
So pensions would be taken into consideration as well. We obviously look at both parties to see if there is pensions on both sides, and we instruct actuaries and specialists kind of come in and advise upon that and how to look at that as a way of a sharing within the matrimonial finances.
And there are usually a few different ways you can split a pension. Do you want to tell us a bit about those?
Yeah, there can be a pension sharing order made in respect of finances. Again, it's all dependent on case by case. And that's obviously when we ask for an actuary to come and advise about the best way to do that and to ensure that there's sharing there as well.
And then you've got earmarking, I understand, is another option. So rather than share the pensions, you just earmark a portion of it to one person's needs and they might get other assets instead.
Mm-hmm. That's correct, yes. So you can apportion a percentage of one person's pension to the other.
When you're saying, is that as in the pension payout, like when you retire? Or is that the savings bit?
Mark, sometimes for us, I've got some clients getting divorced at the moment. And what they're doing is they're getting a valuation of the pensions today for their defined contributions pensions, and that's being included in the total assets and then just split accordingly. So in one example that I have, one client, the husband has a large pension, the wife doesn't have any, and the husband has to transfer some of the money out of his pension into a pension for the wife via a pension sharing order. And there's another client I have where it's a final salary pension. So it doesn't necessarily have a true value now, but it's got a guaranteed income in the future. So there is a calculation taking place via actuaries as to maybe what the value of that is for the wife for now.
What happens if you get divorced two or three times? Do you end up having to share your pension with
You should probably stop getting married.
Yeah.
I'd advise a prenuptial agreement if you are considering being married.
Okay, prenups is also an interesting one, I guess, because we're talking about all these issues of hidden wealth and various financial technicalities. I mean, should people be looking at prenups anyway if there is a lot of money involved before you get married?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I would definitely recommend anyone kind of considering when they're formalising their relationship to enter into a prenuptial agreement. And for those as well that are already married and they want to address their finances, to consider possibly a postnuptial agreement. I mean, I'm sure both you and your listeners are aware that prenuptial and postnuptial agreements are not currently legally binding in England, Wales at the moment. So in order for it to be upheld, the effect of the agreement must be fair. But there's definitely huge benefits of entering into them. So you can record what might happen in the event the marriage breaks down, and who's to have premarital assets or family inheritance can be safeguarded within the agreement.
If they're not legally binding, how are they used? Are they just sort of a guide that the courts may consider?
Yes. So it's used as a determining factor in obviously the division of assets upon divorce. So even though they're not legally binding, they can be used if they are kind of completed in the right way and they are considered to be fair and reasonable. There's a lot of criteria around prenuptial agreements to ensure that they are going to be upheld. Obviously the case of Radmacher ensured that if they are fulfilling the criteria that they should be upheld, but they aren't legally binding, like you said, in England and Wales, but they are a good determining factor as to what should happen upon divorce.
You might have to tell us a bit more about the Rademacher case now.
The Rademacher case, no problem. So
it's a classic. I could tell you about Donoghue versus Stevenson, if that's helpful. That's from my law module at uni.
Yeah, the snail in the ginger ale bottle.
Yeah.
In the case of Rademacher, the Supreme Court made clear that they would give appropriate weight to the tests of the nuptial agreement when deciding how to exercise its discretion, and that they would base upon criteria, for example, if it was freely entered into, both parties had full appreciation of its implications, and they'd use that criteria to determine whether or not it was kind of fair and reasonable.
Okay. So what about wills on divorce, how they impacted?
So the effect of marriage upon your will, when you marry, any existing will is automatically revoked and cancelled and no longer valid. But if you divorce, that will can still be in force. So for example, if your marriage is ended by a court order, for example, a decree absolute, your will is not void or invalid. So any gifts that you make to your former spouse can still take effect. And any kind of guardianships that you make within your will still take effect. So it's definitely advisable to review your will post-divorce.
Are your business assets included if you run your own business? How's that included?
Yes, so businesses would be included within, obviously, the divorce itself. So unlike the cash in the bank, a business is not a liquid asset you can realise immediately and divide up between you and your ex-partner. It doesn't necessarily work like that. But it does get included within the kind of divorce proceedings and the financial settlement. It can be potentially complex dealing with the business on divorce. So the starting point is calculating business's value, and which point we'd obviously instruct an expert, where you can assess obviously the size, the nature of shareholdings, etc. But yes, it does get included.
Does the other partner have to be a shareholder already, or do they get an automatic right to a portion of it?
Not necessarily. It depends case by case how businesses are dealt with upon divorce. But for example, if one party is a shareholder of the business, whether or not they would seek to have other assets on balance of them keeping their shareholding within that business. Again, it depends on what, how to apportion that settlement as a whole. But yes, it can be divided, as in they can obviously have some shareholdings, but it doesn't necessarily work out like that. Sometimes it can be shared through sharing other assets.
Charlotte, have you had any cases where there is a business owned jointly by a husband and wife? I keep saying husband and wife, but obviously it can be husband, husband, wife and wife. But a business jointly owned by a couple where it's really only one person's business, but often the spouse is included for tax purposes. So they might be splitting the salary and dividends, which will then only go to one of them post-divorce. Does my question make sense?
Yes, it does. Yes, I've had that before previously when obviously a client, for example, can be involved in the business. Both parties can be involved in business and also family businesses. So that is definitely an asset that's taken into consideration on the kind of overall settlement. And whether or not, obviously, you'd have to get specialist advice to try and extract one party from that. Because usually, upon divorce, it's better for them to be extracted and not for them to remain in business together.
If assets have to be sold or transferred upon divorce, do the usual things like capital gains tax and stamp duty apply?
Yes, so capital gains tax would definitely be taken into consideration with any transfer or obviously the sale of any property to release funds. That's all taken into consideration as well. That's all factored in when preparing what we call a schedule of assets.
So normally I believe if you transfer assets between husband and wife, there isn't a capital gains tax implication, but if you're doing that as part of a divorce, is that different?
There's been a change in obviously the capital gains rules from April 2020, so it's actually came into effect fairly recently, and that means that divorcing or separating couples in the UK will have a shorter period of time in which to sell their interest in the family home without being hit by any tax penalties. I believe it was the 6th of April. So from the 6th of April, the spouse who moves out of the family home will only have now a 9-month window in which to sell or transfer their share before CGT applies. I believe before it was 18 months. So that's the recent changes.
So would that be the same for business shares and that sort of thing?
Yes, so any kind of share.
Okay. That's interesting. I did not know that.
So you say you knew everything else we've discussed on the podcast?
No, yeah, obviously. Can you tell us about some of your more tricky customers you've come across? Because, I mean, all this does sound complex in itself, but I'm sure there are people who try to get around the rules.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily see clients as tricky customers, but I would definitely say that some clients need a different level of service and support than others. I mean, unlike a commercial transaction or a property purchase, I'm instructed to deal with clients when they're in one of the most worst and stressful times of their life. So I think if I've got a particularly vulnerable client that needs for me to be a barrier between them and their ex-partners, I will try and absorb as much acrimony as possible. But then you have, on the other end of the scale, clients who don't really accept what you're saying and will do the complete opposite of what you've advised. But I mean, all in all, in order to deal with those, you try and give them as much advice as possible. And if they're setting unrealistic expectation, despite your advice, and then are disappointed when you achieve what actually is quite a fair and reasonable settlement for them, you just have to know in the knowledge that you've given them the best advice that you possibly can, and that you've tried to kind of use the law to achieve a settlement for them so they can move on with their lives. But you just have to, try and help them out as much as possible, really.
So it gets stressful?
At times. I suppose every job's quite stressful, but I do enjoy my job.
It's not for Mark. He's at home making music videos all day.
It's quality time with my family. And my wife makes me do it. Is it possible to do all these things without a lawyer?
I mean, I would say no, only because I've seen before clients come to me that have tried to do it themselves and have failed to tick a box that might actually look quite insignificant on the face of it, but can actually mean quite grave circumstances in terms of financial implications later on. So I would say, even if you are considering, or like you said earlier, on amicable terms with your ex-partner, I would still have a solicitor look over it just to double check, because you just can't be too safe. And actually, in the great scheme of things, you probably end up spending a little to save a lot. So I do think it's worthwhile instructing a solicitor.
Moving away from the finances in the divorce, is there a default position when children are involved as to whether a mother or father should be looking after them?
No, there's no default position. Every family is completely different, so it would just depend on their circumstances.
Is that always the case, or was it? Did it used to be that children were deemed to be better with mothers than fathers in sort of the traditional old style family?
I think, I mean, especially in clients that I've dealt with, every family is completely different and unique. So every family setup has its own way of working and what's considered normal, because there is no normal setup. So I definitely think now, especially nowadays, dealing with family law in today's society is completely different, and it's completely dependent on the family setup, really.
What do you enjoy most about being a family solicitor?
What do I enjoy most? Good question. I think finding a solution and assessment for clients, whether it be through finances or children kind of contact arrangement issues, is finding a solution that works well with everyone. And obviously trying to do the best for my client. And like I said earlier, they're going through probably the worst period of their lives when they come to see me. So trying to get them out to the other side and in a strong position so they can stand on both feet and move on with their lives.
Have you ever had people change their minds?
In terms of?
Get back together, just abandon the proceedings.
Oh, you old romantic.
I have had a client that's come to me after going through the whole very acrimonious divorce, reaching a final order, and then a couple of days later reconciling. And then I was instructed to then reinstigate the proceedings. But I've never had a client that's reconciled post-order or post-settlement.
So sorry, that client reconciled but then didn't reconcile after?
Yeah, so they went through years and years of financial proceedings in court and finally reached a settlement, and then a couple of days after, before the order was made final and sealed, they reconciled. And I think they were married for a long time after that, and they came, and then the client came to me after several years and said that she definitely wanted to pursue the divorce.
They gave it again. A go.
Yeah, exactly.
Sounds expensive for them, though.
Yeah, yes.
So I think that covers most of the financial aspects of a marital split. So that's been some useful insights. On a lighter note, there is something else we ask all our guests to take part in. It's a quick fire round looking at how they manage their own finances. So we've got four questions we wanted to fire at you, if that's all right.
Yeah, of course.
Josh, did you want to do the first one?
Sure. What's the best advice you've been given about money, Charlotte?
I mean, it's not the most unique piece of advice, but it has proved me, proved to be the most invaluable, and that's to save as much each month as possible and to take advantage of ISAs. And my dad also taught me to kind of cut my cloth accordingly, which has been probably the best piece of advice, but whether or not it's worked in reality is another thing.
Fantastic.
What does that mean? Cut what?
Cut my cloth accordingly. So basically means don't spend what I don't have.
Oh, really. I see. Good advice. Are you a saver or a spender? That probably answers that question.
Yeah, I think I'm a good balance of both. I'd say definitely in the last month being in lockdown, I would definitely consider myself a saver, but only by default. But month by month, the scales might shift slightly either way. But, yeah.
I think a lot of people are realising in lockdown that they don't necessarily need all the material items that they spend money on normally. It doesn't mean they won't spend when they go back, but they might alter their spending habits a bit.
Yes, it's definitely interesting to see that. Yeah.
So when you do spend, do you use cash or card?
Card, 100%. I can't even remember the last time I had cash on me. So yeah, definitely contactless user.
It's because we're homeschooling our children at the moment and their teachers want us to teach about money, and they're giving us lesson plans to show them coins, and we're looking around our house and I haven't seen a coin in ages.
Is it just notes in your house?
Just notes and contactless cards and Bitcoin. What would you do if you won the lottery?
I think I would clear any debts and clear my friend's student loans and any debts they had. Yeah.
How many student loans would you clear?
The nice ones. So hopefully the ones that the ones that listen. And help family out. I think, yeah, and then be really sensible after and invest. But also I think in light of where we are at the moment, I'd probably look to donate to charitable causes for driving social change, to probably get involved in that way as well.
Lovely.
And finally, where can we find out a bit more about Goodman Derrick?
So if you follow us on LinkedIn, Twitter, or just our website, there's lots of helpful information on our website, the landing page. And I know that other departments, not just family, the family department are obviously happy to give out advice about the current pandemic and how we can help.
So Charlotte, thank you very much for joining us. That's all we have time for.
Thanks for having me.
Please remember, anything discussed in this programme should not be viewed as financial advice. But if you do need support, please contact me at mark@cavendishcontent.com or visit the Orchard Practice website at www.topfs.co.uk.
You can also find us on Twitter at InForAPennyPod1, at Mark Schoffman and at Josh Gerstler. If you'd like to leave us feedback, there's a link in the show notes telling you how to do that. We really appreciate any comments you provide.
And do post any financial issues you'd like us to cover. And thank you for being
in for a penny.
Very fantastic. Good. What a pray. Okay.